It's time for the Picture House Podcast with your hosts, Sam and Simon. Please ensure that your mobile phone is switched off, refrain from smoking, and keep conversation to a minimum. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show!
Colin, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Glad to be part of this journey and being the last interview of the day. You know, it's
last interview for quite a long time. Yeah, I don't see any reason to open my mouth for a while now. I'm going to work.
I guess you go like making a film. It's a lot of like being closed away and doing that stuff, and then you know taking the film out on the road. Is that something that you enjoy? That bit of the process.
I do. I think that, you know, being able to discuss your intentions, to be able to discuss, you know, why, you know, what you spent all that time on has any value, is crucial for filmmakers. And, you know, I can't imagine not doing it. It's been such an important part of each of the films that I've made thus far. So I won't ever stop.
You're working with the same people for quite a long period of time, but then actually to get sort of fresh eyes on it, you know. And
I just like talking to people. It's sort of just like getting outside of the room and you know, having conversations. I think you can get a little isolated, especially on movies like the ones we're doing in the early stages, because you know the circus hasn't come to town yet, and it's just a certain number of people in the office, and it's the same people every day. So it's great to
when you're involved in that. Do you get a chance to like go to the movies? Do you watch other people's films? Or do you have like a couple of years of kind of not really seeing much else?
I get to watch movies. We watch stuff at home. We have, you know, where we're living. We live here in England now, so we live in an old barn. But there is a nice way to watch a movie in there. And so my son and my daughter and I watch a lot of stuff appropriate for children. So yes, I think the challenge is at times to be able to take a break from, you know, curating their childhood full of movies, which is something I take very seriously, and you know, watch something with my wife and see what my peers are doing.
That's nice. It's good. It's good to like stick your head above the and see what's around you.
Oh yeah, it's important. I feel like seeing the kind of choices that people have made is you know, it's been fascinating. You know, it's not just, you know, watching Oscar screeners. It's really just getting out and seeing like, look, this is what my generation is having to say.
Films that we're getting at the moment, I think the quality of like things coming from Hollywood is super high, and we're getting really interesting. If you look at the blockbusters we've had already this year, like it's been just so different. You know, really impressed. You know, from like Wonder Woman to like Kong, and we're not getting the same old stuff.
No, well, because I think Hollywood has no choice. I think that there's been, you know, social media and the ability for people to communicate to each other about the quality of a film, about how the audience feels about a film, has changed the game. And I think, in a great way. And I think it's actually allowed films that, you know, might have otherwise not found as large an audience to really, really succeed. You know, a movie like Get Out, which is such a small film, to reach the level of success it has, like that happens because people immediately watch the film and tweet to everybody they know, you have to go see this movie.
I think people often forget about the word of mouth element, and I think it's so important, especially when you have a film like Get Out, to show it to people and like celebrate it. You know, get it out there in advance, and don't just rely on the movie ads and the trailers.
Well, it works
people
both
try and
ways.
Skip the ads, you know.
But you know, it definitely works both ways, and I think that's the reason why, you know, there's such a focus on quality and delivering a film that just fires on all of its cylinders is that if that opposite thing happens to you, if the film. The film audience tweets to everybody and just says, oh my God, you don't want to have this experience, then that's exactly what will happen.
I think what you're saying about like, you know, actually looking around at what your peers are doing is really important. The other day I watched Baby Driver and War of the Planet of the Apes, and both of them have a lot of sign language in there. I was like, oh, that's an interesting 2017 trend in two major Hollywood blockbusters. And then also, when I watched Book of Henry, the day after I watched War of the Planet of the Apes, Michael Giacchino. Michael Giacchino is everywhere.
Yeah,
I just don't understand how he keeps the quality so high on the amount of films he works on. What's your relationship like with Michael?
It's strong, and it's a very collaborative and creative relationship that extends beyond just the music. You know, he's not going to do a movie that he doesn't believe in, and so, you know, the fact that he has three movies this summer is a little bit to do with, you know, the length of time it takes to make an Apes movie.
Yes.
The length of time that, you know, that we shot this movie a bit of time ago because I had to get it done immediately after Jurassic in order to fit it into my schedule. And then Spider-Man was right on schedule, and then he also did Rogue One, which he had to do in a very short period of time. So, you know, it's just this confluence of Giacchino.
It's great as well that someone, you know, because like he's a really popular composer, but the quality is high and everything is different. And I think it's amazing that he can work like that and be involved in so many films. It's great for cinema goers.
Yeah. He came to the premiere the other night and he brought his mom, and his mom loved the movie so much, but it was so loved that he did it. That, you know, oh, you see you with the superheroes, and I see you with the monkeys, but you did this movie about a family. It was beautiful.
I think it gets him, so like when I started watching the film, I think one of the first shots is that amazing bridge that you have in the landscape, and I think the score kind of comes in, and I started thinking like Bernard Herrmann and Hitchcock and stuff.
Yeah, the score is really, it's so restrained, you know, and I think that for someone who's, you know, cut his teeth over so many years on, you know, these pretty big movie scores. It was a smaller orchestra, a smaller number of instruments, and he was constantly pushing to take music out and not use music and just let it play. And there's a couple moments where we use something really sparse and he was like, I'm telling you, you could just not do anything. And I watch it and I'm like, yeah, he's totally right. Like, we could have not done anything. And I think that he was so challenged by the level of emotion in the movie and finding a way to you know, accompany that as simply as possible, because the minute that you just, you know, you go into some kind of flowing piano piece, you know, the wheels are going to come off the whole thing. And I love his opening, his overture, you know, that plays over the animated piece. The thing that he did that I think, because it's pretty sparse, you know, for much of it, but the piece that he does at the end where he manages to score two completely different kinds of parallel action together and have you believe each one of them. It was pretty amazing work.
You mentioned sort of Michael working to a smaller level, and I guess for you after Jurassic World, like going to Book of Henry, was it kind of refreshing, or was it like,
I thought it was going to be refreshing, but it was so much harder.
Oh, really?
And so like I just miscalculated that in such a big way that I felt that, well, because of the size of this, it's a small independent movie, and you know that somehow that would equal easier or less stressful. Wrong on both accounts. it was a real challenge, and you know, being able to navigate, you know, the tone of the film in the context of the way the narrative changes and shifts and evolves jarringly at times, and in ways that, you know, make you doubt the motivations of the characters, and you're dealing with so many different kinds of elements of the relationship that you have with the audience, that making that all come together, as opposed to something like Jurassic World that has one tone, and you know, you just have to nail it the whole way through, and you know, even if there are moments of surprise, you know, you're not completely pulling the rug out from anybody or flipping the chess table over.
It's like what I really liked about this film is like you give your actors room to act, you know, like there are some really great, you know, not always dialogue scenes, but long dialogue scenes, long drama scenes, and some really like hard scenes to, they must be hard scenes to work on set, especially, you know, sort of midway through the film when it's quite emotional. Yeah. I was so close to tears and it really got me. I didn't realize how invested I was until I was like, oh, I really, like, look, what are you doing to me, Colin?
Yeah, it's my favorite it's my favorite kind of movie. I remember, you know, even in films that I responded to as a child that really just pulled you in very slowly and you are just kind of going along with it and you're like, all right, here are these characters and this is what they're doing, and I guess, and then by the time you get to the, you know, to what it's going to do, you had no idea that you were so emotionally invested. I remember feeling that way about Casper. Remember that Casper movie?
Yeah.
Which, like, when I watch it now, like, I'm not sure if I have the same response. But when I saw it at that time, I was like, yeah, whatever, whatever. And then I get to the very end, and suddenly that movie just, like, punched me in the face.
Certain things are, like, especially about childhood, and, like, Casper especially, is all about, you know, when you see him and he's a real boy, you know, he's not just that cartoon ghost.
Yeah. It's amazing how you can... So if the strings pull tight on something, like if it sticks its landing, it can be tremendously effective. And that's, you know, for people who've seen the movie, both of you, you know, I think you'll agree that, you know, there's something that this movie does specifically for parents, and then or specifically for brothers or sisters or anyone who had a sibling. If if you allow yourself to go with it, which I think for a lot of people, understandably, is a challenge because of what the movie does. But if you know, it's kind of like a fever dream. It's kind of a parental fever dream in a lot of ways. And if you let yourself go, it can really take you to some really emotional places. In ways, it's like Poltergeist, where like, you know, yeah, the family's just kind of hanging out and working, and the dog's eating the waffles, and like everything seems fine. And then, you know, it's suddenly, by the time you get to the end, if you were to watch the opening couple scenes, you know, next to the final few scenes, like the idea that it would start there and end there would blow your mind. I think this movie just takes you places that, because other movies haven't gone before to those places, I can understand how it might feel, you know, preposterous to some, but I don't think it is. There's nothing that happens in this movie that hasn't happened in real life.
I think it's about suspending your disbelief, which is what people pay good money to do when they go to the cinema. And I think maybe it's because it's the family unit, you know, and it's like a domestic drama. Mm-hmm. But you know, like, but we're in a cinema, and we want to see not reality. We want to see something exciting and something different. And I think this film does that. Like, genuinely, like, I'd love. In that final scene in the woods, you have that beautiful like ballet sequence as well, which is, it's so good. And it's like, it's such a great thing to cut away to when there's people running through the woods, you know, and like the stakes are so high. And I guess it's like a tried and tested cinema technique, but again, like, we don't see that very often.
Yeah,
you know, cutting to
baptism scene in The Godfather.
Like, absolutely.
But I felt like Kevin Stitt, my editor, you know, he worked on that with me in our snowed-in editing room in Vermont for quite a while. We almost went crazy. It was a little bit of a shining situation over that winter. But, you know, to be able to have something that is, you know, both side of those what we're cross-cutting against, both pieces of action were crucial. And the baptism scene, like the actual baptism of the baby, doesn't really affect the story.
Yeah.
And so I was so interested in this, the result of each of those sequences, the combination of those two things, you know, results in the end of the film. But without each of them going well, everything would have fallen apart.
It's like one of my cinematic kind of soft spots is like when you see like school presentations or talent shows. And you do such a good job in that final scene when the kids are all doing their like various bits and bobs. Like, I think it's impossible not to like just remember your own childhood or like be attached to that.
Well, we also like the way we shot the talent show, especially from the perspective of the girl in the talent show. Whenever you looked out at the audience, it had that feeling of the light shining in your eyes and barely being able to see people. And I found that, you know, usually when they do any kind of like show or you can always see the audience so clearly, and like that, when you're a kid, it's this very sort of disorienting feeling of being up there, and we wanted to make sure to capture, you know, every part of that.
Well, you also have to, like, that ticking time bomb sort of thing. She has 45 minutes to get back there. And I was sort of like, I was a bit worried about her and the things she was doing, but I was more worried about the show finishing and his mom not being there. Like,
right.
That was emotional stake there. Like, I mean, yeah,
that's
like, what
that's
she's
where
doing
we ended.
Problems for her with the police and things, but like, it's actually, she doesn't want to, I didn't want her to disappoint her son.
No, and she's making such horrible decisions. And I think that, I mean, to me, the whole movie was, it's about that feeling you have as a parent that your kids are in such horrible danger and it's out of your control, and I could see how in a situation of grief that she would really descend to a place where she would think that was a viable solution, which is what made it really hard to market the movie. Because even in the marketing, I don't know if you saw the trailer that they did, but you know, you show the family drama part and then you show the ending, but without the middle, it makes you don't really understand why she's doing that, or if the filmmakers are saying, well, we endorse this as a way to handle the situation, which is the whole point of the movie, is the exact opposite of that. And so it's a hard movie to both to sell and to rely on the audience to stick with you all the way to the end, you know, via a series of decisions made by both Henry and his mother that you could be strongly disagree with because they're morally wrong, and yet trust that, like, well, this gymnast is going to stick this landing, even if she feels like she's wobbling, like it's going to happen.
I think you're right, actually. The trailer must be such a challenge, because like people, before I saw the film, people were like, oh, that's the film where this happened. And so I went in thinking a certain thing. Yeah. It wasn't that film at all.
No, it's like, not. No.
And I think I love that in the first hour you get to know the family unit, which, again, people were like, oh, they weren't focusing on that stuff. So every time, like when the three of them were together, for as long as they are, I was actually really surprised, because I also just loved them together, so I didn't really want it to end.
Well, it really, I mean, and also it's, and I don't ask you to rewatch it, but anyone who ever does, not only is the entire movie laid out in the animated sequence at the beginning, visually, you know, the trajectory from the treehouse to Sickleman, it's all there. But, you know, it is structured like a thriller. It's edited like a thriller from the start. And so there's so many, all the pieces of the Rube Goldberg machine of story that fire off are laid into that first 45 minutes when you just sort of feel like you're watching a family, and hopefully you don't process consciously that all that stuff, all that work is being done.
I think that, like, the suburban setting, you know, the white picket fences and those big houses together, like, they lend themselves so well to that sort of, you know, it's the darker side, isn't it, of suburbia.
Yeah, it's like a Grimm's fairy tale. I love that we found those houses that had a little bit of, like, a, you know, that frosted cake German Black Forest kind of vibe to it. Because, you know, in the end, I found it to be a very old story, like the idea that you would, you know, carry on the deeds of one who was lost in their absence feels like almost a, you know, a biblical story or again, a, you know, a fairy tale or a fable. And so finding a way to, you know, with that treehouse and with, you know, the design of their room, like everything feeling like just slightly hyper-real, just like a step above in the same way that I think Safety does and even Jurassic. Like those movies operate in this like slightly heightened reality where you're going to believe things that in our world would potentially be unbelievable. But each of the movies, even this one, it sort of traffics in an area that is a little bit outside, you know, what we would buy, you know.
Right. I mean, it looks like 2017, and Jurassic looks like 2015, and say, like, they look like they're right here, right now. But there's like one fantastical element, and in this, it's not a dinosaur or a time machine. It's, you know, it's just something different.
Yeah.
It's a book.
It's a book. That was the intention.
But I think you're right, though. That the book, like, is such a great cinematic device. I recently watched My Cousin Rachel, where the character's vision is skewed because he's getting letters from a dead cousin, and when he meets Rachel Weisz, he sort of has a perception of her, and it's not that at all. And like, again, it's like it's a tried and tested device. That just works.
Right.
And I guess that's Daphne du Maurier, and again, it's the Hitchcock thing as well.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, because so I think very few, there's very few dramas just made for, you know, for adults that are, that, you know, outside of, you know, the art house, which is, you know, most of the movies I see, but I recognize that, you know, there's a massive mainstream audience who needs certain things from their films that don't get them that often, and when they get it, they really appreciate it, and I felt like this movie delivered in that way on you know, all the things you go to the movies for. You know, you cry, you laugh, you know you're on the edge of your seats, you have an emotional, you know, deep emotional response. And I think for a lot of people, you know, it's not a movie that you just like drive home and like, whatever, let's get something to eat. Like, you're going to talk about that movie.
I love that chat after the cinema. That's like my favorite thing.
Yeah.
The hour, it's usually like about an hour on the way home, whoever I'm with. Like, if the film has really hit home, we will just talk nonstop.
Yes.
And that's just what I love. And, you know, like, whatever it's about, it sometimes it's really obscure things, you know. But I just love that it gives us that chance to have that conversation.
Yeah, and I think in the case of this, it's what the hell did I just watch? And can somebody talk to me about it?
I think there was the thing I definitely spoke about was, I think the way Naomi Watts, I think it's Naomi Watts, or the kid, Jacob, it's like, we need to kill Glenn. And I just, like, I did not expect that to come out of that person's mouth. And then there's that great exchange, because they're like, you can't kill Mr. I can't remember his last name.
Mr. Sickleman, yeah.
Mr. Sickleman. And then she reads it, we need to kill Glenn. Mr. Sickleman. And like, that was just the moment where, it, like I say, like, that was the jumping up a notch.
Yeah.
Like, okay, strap myself in. Here we go.
It's a movie.
Also, finally, just because I know this is the last time you're going to open your mouth for
TV. Yeah, it is, yeah.
Naomi Watts playing video games.
Uh-huh.
What was your direction?
On how to do it?
She's really into it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was it, like her being fascinated and into it is part of it. You know, I play video games, and I think that, you know, there's, to me, that was, I see how that could be perceived as us like doing some kind of, you know, bricklaying for why she might be a good sniper, and I never saw it that way, because
I did not think about it until you just said that.
No, like, but I saw, like, there was some review that was like, clearly the filmmakers wanted us to believe that by playing Gears of War is like a heavy machine gun game.
Absolutely.
It's not a sniper game.
It's not sniping. I love that game so much.
Yeah, it's great, but like, you would not use that it would be Call of Duty, Lynch. She would have been a sniper in that. But, you know, the Gears of War is unbelievably fun in its, you know, melee quality. And I think that, you know, what that was about for me is that we are, you know, a lot of us are parents, but we feel like kids inside still, and we play games like kids, and we haven't quite grown up internally. And yet, as this character, you know, discovers in her evolution over the course of the film, like, you have to realize at some point that your kids are looking to you for some guidance on how to be. And so really that was just, you know, making it very clear that she's just as much of a child as the rest of us.
Well, you get to have that great exchange where her son tells her off for, like, you know,
playing video games. Really?
Yeah. That was brilliant. Thank you so much for talking to us, Colin.
All right,
and
thanks.
Yeah, enjoy London.
Listening to the Picture House podcast, a Picture House's production brought to you by Picture House Cinemas. We would like to thank everyone who works at Picture House Cinemas and everyone who has ever attended a screening of a film at a Picture House cinema. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.